Hello everyone, before we begin this episode, I just wanted to mention that during the month of February, The Trail Went Cold is partnering with Season of Justice, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping families shed new light on their cold cases and helping investigative agencies bridge the funding gap, preventing them from accessing cutting-edge forensic technology. So we would like to invite you, the listeners, to join us in a special campaign in support of Season of Justice, who works directly with families to fund comprehensive awareness campaigns in hopes of bringing a resolution to unsolved cases. Season of Justice provides grants to investigative agencies that fund DNA testing and forensic genetic genealogy research to solve cold cases, and since 2020, they have raised more than $1 million in grants for more than 140 cold cases in North America. In fact, six of them have wound up being solved. But since Season of Justice can't do this alone, we're asking you to consider donating this month. If you are able to make a meaningful donation to them, you can be helping victims' families find answers. To donate to Season of Justice, please visit the website givebutter.com/SOJ_the trail or text trail24 to 53555. You'll also find links and information about this in our show notes and on our social media pages. Our campaign with Season of Justice will be lasting the entire month of February, and there will be more reminders on our upcoming episodes. So thank you very much for your support, and enjoy today's episode. February 11th, 2004. Lake Township, Pennsylvania. After returning home from work, 22-year-old Felicia Thomas goes missing, and her boyfriend's best friend, Stephen Allen Martin, soon becomes a person of interest. 2.5 years earlier, an 18-year-old friend of Felicia's named Jennifer Barzilowski had also disappeared, and since Steve was the last known person to see Jennifer alive, there is speculation that the cases are connected. Over the years, rumors circulate that Felicia may have been murdered at a party, but while Jennifer's skull is found in a wooded area in 2010, there are no conclusive answers about how she died, and Felicia remains a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today, we're going to be covering two cold cases from the same township in Pennsylvania. The 2004 disappearance of Felicia Thomas, and the 2001 disappearance and death of Jennifer Barzilowski. Looking back through my lengthy list of case requests, this story was originally suggested to me about 5 years ago by a listener named Peter, who told me that one of his daughters happened to go to school with Felicia Thomas. And since the date of this episode's release is only 4 days away from the 20th anniversary of Felicia's disappearance, I thought now would be a good time to cover it. We'll also be discovering the disappearance of Jennifer Barzilowski, which took place 2.5 years earlier, though her case barely received any attention at all until Felicia went missing. In addition to them both living in the same area, Felicia and Jennifer happened to be friends, and the big link between them was a man named Stephen Allen Martin, who was the boyfriend of Jennifer's older sister and the best friend of Felicia's boyfriend. Since he commonly went by Steve, yes, that technically means that his name was Steve Martin, and I promise not to make any only murders in the building jokes during the episode. While investigators considered Steve to be a person of interest in both cases, there was no real evidence against him, though a prevalent rumor is that Felicia attended a party with Steve on the night of her disappearance, and multiple people were responsible for killing her and disposing of her remains. There would be a bit of a resolution in Jennifer's case when her skull was found in a wooded area in 2010, but the rest of her remains have not been recovered and her cause of death is still unknown. This is a very strange and frustrating story which seems to be filled with unconfirmed rumors and innuendo, but the fact of the matter is that there are still no conclusive answers about what happened to both of these victims, which is why we're going to explore these cases on this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on a regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the cases of Felicia Thomas and Jennifer Barzilowski. Our story begins in 2004 in Lake Township, Pennsylvania, which is located in Luzerne County as part of their Back Mountain region and had a population of just over 2,000 people at that time. Our first victim is 22-year-old Felicia Thomas, who is the fourth of seven children born to her mother, Pauline Bailey. Felicia spent much of her childhood living with her family in Dorrance Township, and while she has dropped out of high school, she currently works as a clerk at a pump and pantry convenience store located on State Route 29. For nearly 3 years, Felicia has been involved in a relationship with her 27-year-old live-in boyfriend, Ed Radosky. The couple tried living with Felicia's mother for a while, but since Ed was also a high school dropout who would not get a job and help pay the bills, Pauline made them move out. At this particular point, Felicia and Ed are now living with Ed's mother, Catherine Radosky, at her residence on State Route 118. At around 11 p.m. on the evening of February the 11th, Felicia finished her shift at the pump and pantry and was given a ride home by a male friend of one of her co-workers. This person would later confirm that he dropped Felicia off and saw her enter the Radosky residence, but what supposedly happened next is Ed Radosky's version of events. According to Ed, he had fallen asleep on the couch, but sometime between 11:30 p.m. and midnight, Felicia woke him up by giving him a hug and kiss. Ed said that they chatted for a brief period and discussed their upcoming plans for Valentine's Day, as they were hoping to go on a horse-drawn sleigh ride to celebrate their 3-year anniversary as a couple. Felicia wanted to have some beers with Ed, but he said he was too tired, and told her that since his mother did not allow alcohol in the house, he was keeping some beer in his ATV outside. Ed then said that he fell back asleep, and recalled hearing Felicia walk outside, and he woke up over an hour later sometime between 1 o'clock and 1:30 a.m. on the morning of February the 12th. When Ed got up and walked into his bedroom, he was surprised to discover that Felicia was not there, and he could not find her anywhere inside or outside the house. Since Felicia's cigarettes were missing, Ed initially assumed that she went somewhere, but curiously, her purse and winter coat had been left behind, even though it was a cold February night. Ed went outside and noticed that the beer on his ATV had not been touched, so he decided to use the ATV to ride over to a friend's house about a mile away to check if Felicia might be there. When he discovered that no one was at the house, Ed rode back home to wait for her. Now, here's where things get sketchy. Even though Felicia never resurfaced, she was not actually reported missing to the Pennsylvania State Police until 5:30 p.m. on February the 13th, which was over 40 hours after she was last seen. It was Felicia's mother, Pauline Bailey, who filed the missing persons report, and Pauline and Ed seemed to have differing accounts of what transpired. During the earliest media coverage of this case, Ed told the Wilkes-Barre Times-Leader newspaper that he wasn't initially concerned because there were no signs of forced entry at his residence, and he hadn't heard or seen anything suspicious. At one point, Ed went under hypnosis to see if he could remember any more details about his last encounter with Felicia, and he said he recalled hearing what sounded like the front door closing and then a car door closing outside as he was falling asleep on the couch. Ed said that he believed Felicia had left to go visit her mother in Dorrance Township, but since he didn't have any minutes left on his long-distance calling card, Ed was unable to phone Pauline to check if Felicia was there. It was not until Ed called the pump and pantry one day later and learned that Felicia had not shown up for her next scheduled shift when he started to become worried. After speaking to numerous people and learning that no one had seen or heard from Felicia in 2 days, he finally got in touch with Pauline, and she subsequently contacted the Pennsylvania State Police to report Felicia missing. Well, over the years, Pauline has shared a different version of how these events unfolded. She claimed that she first learned that her daughter was missing when the pump and pantry called her on February the 13th to inform her that Felicia had not shown up to collect her most recent paycheck. When Pauline called the Radosky residence to check what was going on, she said that Ed's mother, Catherine, answered the phone and told her that Felicia had just stepped out in order to go pick up her check, which turned out not to be true. It was after this when Pauline decided to file a missing persons report for Felicia. What makes things even more complicated is that a neighbor of the Radoskys later contacted Pauline and told her that during the early morning hours of February the 12th, they had seen 4 people leaving the Radosky residence on ATVs, but only 3 of them came back. These 3 people then apparently spent the next few hours leaving and coming back on their ATVs multiple times. While this was going on, a black truck was parked in front of the Radosky residence before someone drove it away at 4:30 a.m. However, it's been reported that the police have never taken the neighbor's account all that seriously, as the neighbor apparently had some sort of personal issue with Ed, and investigators felt they may have been fabricating stories in an attempt to get Ed into trouble. In spite of these odd discrepancies between Ed and Pauline's version of events, the police have stated that Ed was nothing but cooperative with the investigation, and they have never considered him to be a suspect. It's been reported that Ed took a polygraph test, and while he claimed that he passed it, the police have never confirmed or denied this. They also do not believe that the man who drove Felicia home on the night she disappeared was a suspect either. In the days following Felicia's disappearance, investigators would uncover some mysterious notes alleging that Felicia's body could be found behind the Mountain Fresh supermarket located on State Route 118, only about a tenth of a mile away from the Radosky residence. This supermarket would become the unofficial command center for the search effort, but even though members of law enforcement and numerous volunteers would extensively check the area behind the market and the surrounding woods, nothing could be found. Well, on February the 20th, the Pennsylvania State Police obtained a warrant to search a residence on Golf Course Road in nearby Ross Township. The residence belonged to 30-year-old Stephen Allen Martin, who happened to be Ed Radosky's best friend. An ATV was confiscated from Steve's house, along with several guns, ammunition, ashtrays with cigarette butts, and garbage bags filled with empty beer cans, but at the time, police would not publicly comment on what, if any, evidence might have been found. It turned out that sometime between 11:30 p.m. and midnight on February the 11th, Steve had called the Radosky residence to speak with Ed, as he claimed they had made plans to see each other that night. But Felicia wound up answering the phone and told Steve that Ed was sleeping before he hung up. If this story was true, this technically made Steve the last known person to communicate with Felicia before she vanished, so he was considered to be a person of interest in the case. For his part, Steve denied any involvement in her disappearance, claiming that he went to bed shortly after he spoke with Felicia. Steve also claimed that at around 4 a.m., he was awakened by a phone call from his girlfriend, Leanne Barzalowski, who told him that she had received 5 prank calls from someone breathing heavily into the receiver, and she was quite perturbed about it. This prompted Steve to travel to Leanne's house in order to comfort her before he returned home later that morning. Well, believe it or not, it would turn out that Steve had another connection to an unsolved missing persons case from the area. The victim in question was 18-year-old Jennifer Barzalowski, who happened to be the younger sister of Steve's girlfriend, Leanne. Jennifer also lived in Lake Township, and went missing on the evening of June the 23rd, 2001. It turned out that Steve was the last known person to see her alive, as he claimed that he gave Jennifer a ride to the C Major Sports Bar located on Main Street in the borough of Edwardsville and dropped her off before driving away. Her case was originally investigated by the Lake Township Police Department, who wound up disbanding a few months later, so it was taken over by the Pennsylvania State Police. Jennifer's disappearance initially got very little coverage in the media, as an article published in the July 3, 2001 edition of the Wilkes-Barre Times-Leader said that she was a known heroin user. At the time, it was believed that Jennifer had traveled to the Badlands neighborhood in Philadelphia to score drugs, and Steve seemed to concur with this theory. However, Jennifer's case would be given renewed attention when Felicia went missing 2.5 years later, as it turned out there were no independent eyewitnesses who recalled seeing Jennifer at the C Major Sports Bar on the night she vanished and could corroborate Steve's story. For his part, Steve claimed that he drove to Leanne's residence right after dropping off Jennifer and told the press that Leanne could attest to his whereabouts that night. Since Leanne and Steve were still together and now had 2 small children, it did not appear that Leanne had suspected him of anything. In fact, Leanne had even named her infant daughter Jennifer after her sister. In another interesting turn of events, it turned out that Jennifer and Felicia were friends and knew a number of the same people. Even though Steve would become a person of interest in both cases, there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong, but his life would soon go into a downward spiral. Steve's legal problems began on March the 17th, only 1 month after Felicia went missing, when he was arrested on the first-degree misdemeanor charge of possessing a prohibited offensive weapon. When a pair of state troopers visited Steve's residence in order to interview him about Felicia's case, they noticed a sawed-off shotgun lying on a wooden stand next to a staircase, and it would be confiscated during the police's search of the house 5 days later. While this charge was later dismissed, Steve started facing more serious issues 2 months later when he was accused of supplying drugs and alcohol to a pair of teenage girls. He allegedly lured these 2 girls to his house by offering to pay them to clean it, though he never actually gave them any money. Steve was charged with 2 counts each of delivering marijuana, endangering the welfare of children, corruption of minors, and providing alcohol to minors, along with a single count of furnishing tobacco to a minor. While he was released on bond, things got even worse for Steve in July of that year, when he was rearrested and charged with endangering the welfare of children, corruption of minors, giving alcohol to minors, and possessing a controlled substance. Over 1 2-year period, Steve had supposedly supplied alcohol and drugs to a pair of completely different teenage girls, and was also accused of fondling one of them. Once again, Steve was allowed to remain free on bond, but these new allegations were only increasing suspicion about his potential involvement in the disappearances of Felicia and Jennifer. When Steve appeared at the Luzerne County Courthouse for a hearing about these charges, a bunch of protesters showed upside, including Pauline Bailey. They held up signs which read, quote, "Number 1, Jen, Number 2, Felicia, Number 3, your daughter," and Pauline flat out yelled at Steve, quote, "You took my daughter. How does it feel to rip someone's heart out?" End quote. Well, believe it or not, Steve would be rearrested and hit with even more charges in November, including burglary, indecent assault, and corruption of minors. These charges stem from an incident in January of 2003, when Steve illegally entered a friend's home and crawled into bed with 2 teenage girls, where he attempted to undo one of their bras. The adult woman who resided in the home said that she remained silent because Steve had threatened to burn her house down, but she now wanted to come forward due to all the newfound publicity surrounding him and his additional charges. Even though this marked the 4th time Steve was arrested in 2004, he was once again released on bond, but shortly thereafter, Leanne filed a protection from abuse order against him, which led to their 2 children being removed from Steve's custody. While Leanne would withdraw the order 5 days later, it wasn't long before Steve found himself involved in an accident which took someone's life. On December the 9th, Steve drove his pickup truck to the Luzerne County Children and Youth Services Office in Wilkes-Barre in order to attend a supervised visit with his children, but the Pennsylvania State Police received information that Steve was driving with a suspended license due to a previous DUI conviction. Some state troopers waited outside the office and attempted to pull Steve over after he left, but he decided to speed up and lead the police on a brief chase until he ran a red light and crashed into a car containing 61-year-old Raymond Simon and his 55-year-old sister, Vera Simon. Steve attempted to flee the accident scene on foot before he was captured at a Taco Bell restaurant several blocks away. He was charged with 2 counts of reckless endangerment, along with 1 count each of accident involving death or injury, fleeing police, and driving without a license. Raymond and Vera Simon were taken to a hospital and placed in the intensive care unit, but while Raymond made a full recovery, Vera passed away on December the 20th. Steve was then hit with the additional charges of vehicular homicide and involuntary manslaughter, and this time he was held at the Luzerne County Correctional Facility without bail. Rather than go on trial, Steve agreed to a plea deal, and on March the 29th, 2005, he pled guilty to all charges in relation to Vera's death and received a sentence of 51 to 126 months in prison. In June of that year, Steve pled guilty to all of the other charges he had faced involving the numerous teenage girls, such as corruption of minors and indecent assault. Interestingly enough, one of the girls he had victimized claimed that Steve once told her he was the last person to see Jennifer Barzilowski alive. She stated, quote, "He said everyone tried to blame him. He said everyone thinks he did it, but he didn't say what he meant by did it," end quote. Later that month, a wrongful death lawsuit that Vera Simon's family had filed against Steve was settled out of court. Steve was scheduled to be sentenced for his charges with the teenage girls sometime in mid-August, and was held in custody at the State Correctional Institution in Camp Hill. However, on the morning of August the 12th, Steve was found hanging by his neck inside his cell. He was immediately rushed to a medical center and died the following day at the age of 32. His death was ruled to be a suicide, as a few days earlier, Steve had sent a letter to Leanne's aunt in which he wrote, quote, "Hopefully soon I will be dead and I will not have to deal with this pain no more," end quote. Shortly before Steve died, Leanne had informed him that she was now dating someone else, and she soon made this statement to the press, quote, "I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place as far as this is concerned. He killed my sister, and I love him," end quote. Leanne said that she never wanted to believe that Steve was responsible for Jennifer's disappearance, but following Steve's incarceration, the lead detective on Jennifer's case spoke to Leanne and finally convinced her that Steve was the guilty party. Since Jennifer and Felicia's remains had still not been found, Steve's suicide was a bittersweet feeling for their families, but over the next several years, Pauline Bailey would publicly express her belief that multiple people were involved in Felicia's disappearance and Steve did not act alone. Well, on April the 2nd, 2010, two teenagers riding their ATVs through Hunlock Township discovered a human skull near the bottom of an embankment in a secluded wooded area alongside Roaring Brook Creek. The authorities were soon notified about the discovery, and 10 days later, it was announced that dental records had positively identified the skull as belonging to Jennifer Barzilowski. Unfortunately, an extensive search of the area failed to turn up the rest of Jennifer's remains. Based on the available evidence, Jennifer's exact cause of death could not be determined, but when the Luzerne County Coroner's Office examined her skull, they did not find any perforated marks to suggest that a cutting tool had been used to detach it from her spine. Since this particular wooded area was apparently searched on prior occasions without finding anything, it was theorized that the skull may have been brought to the spot it was found via animal activity, or possibly even flooding or heavy rain. Indeed, there have always been rumors that Felicia's remains and the rest of Jennifer's remains were dumped into one of the large ponds in the area, which discharge into Roaring Brook Creek, explaining how Jennifer's skull flowed to this spot. While the authorities have never officially stated that Jennifer was the victim of homicide, it seems very likely she was the victim of foul play. And interestingly enough, her skull was only found about a mile away from the residence where Steve Martin had lived before his arrest. Well, as the years went on, Pauline would publicly express her belief that Felicia was murdered because she knew incriminating information about what happened to Jennifer. In January of 2012, a letter from Pauline was published in the Letters to the Editor section of another Wilkes-Barre newspaper, The Citizen's Voice, where she wrote, quote, "Some very bad people hurt her and killed her, as they did Jen Barzilowski. She told me someone killed her friend and buried her and wanted me to help find her. I did not believe it. I told her in this day and age, you can't kill people and get away with it. God, why didn't I listen to her?" End quote. It has since come out that Felicia specifically told her mother that she believed Steve Martin had killed Jennifer, and Pauline theorized that this was Steve's motive for making Felicia disappear. Well, in April of 2016, the story would be featured on an episode of the true crime show Crime Watch Daily, which pushed forward a specific scenario for how Felicia was allegedly murdered. Pauline was interviewed on the show, along with a close family friend named Judy Fisher, who had become a major advocate in Felicia's case. Pauline and Judy both claimed that they were told by numerous people that on the night Felicia disappeared, she had attended a party at a mobile home located in Hunlock Township on Timber Lane off Golf Course Road. The home was owned by a man named John Anthony Neary, who was friends with Steve Martin, and Steve's residence was only about a half mile away. There were supposedly at least 17 people at the party, and the story goes that Steve and at least three other men convinced Felicia to join her inside a bedroom in order to smoke some marijuana. They then proceeded to sexually assault Felicia, and she apparently let out some disturbing screams for help, which prompted a couple of people to leave. In fact, it's been reported that Steve drove both Felicia and Ed Radosky to the party. After they arrived, Ed went inside the bedroom with Felicia, but the other guys told him to, quote-unquote, take a walk, so Ed left while Felicia's assault took place. One of these guys was also supposedly seen carrying a video camera into the bedroom, implying that the assault may have been filmed. Afterward, multiple witnesses apparently went into the bedroom and saw Felicia's dead body wrapped in a blanket. One of the most prevalent rumors is that the responsible parties took Felicia into a barn located on the same property and proceeded to dismember her body on top of a large tarp. They then burned her remains in a debris pile and buried them in a vegetable garden in a field on top of a nearby hill. But here's where the whole thing gets confusing. The Crime Watch Daily episode features an interview with Officer Tom Kelly, who was the lead investigator with the Pennsylvania State Police at that time, and he does confirm that Felicia was seen attending this party at the mobile home. But he also said that she was last seen leaving the party with Steve Martin and another unidentified male. This other guy was subsequently dropped off at his own place, leaving Felicia and Steve alone, and Felicia was never seen alive again. But when asked if the second male was Ed Radosky, Kelly just said he could not confirm or deny it. So the big issue here is that we have two separate stories about this party which completely contradict each other, because if Felicia was seen leaving the party with Steve, then she obviously couldn't have been killed inside the bedroom. For his part, Kelly said that he has never found any evidence or information to confirm the rumors that a so-called quote-unquote snuff film had been shot of Felicia's alleged assault and murder. It's also worth noting that Jennifer's skull was found about 3/4 to 1 mile downstream from the barn where Felicia's dismemberment supposedly took place, and the barn was right next to a feeder creek to Roaring Brook Creek. Shortly before the Crime Watch Daily episode came out, the previous owners of this property had moved away, so Pauline and Judy got permission from the new owners to perform a search of the property with cadaver dogs in August of 2016. They claimed that these dogs got hits on a deteriorating tarp found in a wooded area 100 yards behind the barn, as well as the stone floor in the corner of the barn. There was also apparently a noticeable dip in this floor to indicate that some sort of excavation might have occurred. By this point, the mobile home where this party supposedly took place had been demolished, and the debris burn pile on the property had been removed, graded, and seeded. Now, the Pennsylvania State Police said that they later performed their own search of the property with the same cadaver dogs, but did not get any hits at the spots where the dogs had allegedly reacted during Pauline's previous search, and they also did not find anything of evidentiary value. However, Pauline and Judy have claimed that they've since performed additional private searches of the property with cadaver dogs and continued to get hits from them, but never found anything. The Wilkes-Barre Times Leader ran a couple of articles about this story in early 2018, and while they attempted to get comment from the property's previous owner, John Anthony Neary, they were unable to track him down. However, on the 14-year anniversary of Felicia's disappearance, the Times Leader revealed that they had been contacted by several anonymous individuals who claimed they had been inside Neary's mobile home during the spring of 2004 and noticed that floorboards were conspicuously missing in the bedroom and kitchen. As of right now, all further search efforts to recover Felicia and the rest of Jennifer's remains have been unsuccessful. So after 20 years, there's still no conclusive answers about what happened to either of these victims. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is not the first time I've done an episode featuring two separate cold cases, and more often than not, I find out that one of the featured cases got considerably more media coverage than the other. As an example of this, look at the episode I released 2 weeks ago about the murders of Heidi Seaman and Erica Bateo, which both took place in San Antonio in August of 1990. I think the only reason that Erica's case got any media coverage at all is because she happened to go missing only 19 days after Heidi did, so the city was in a major frenzy about abducted children and rumors about the two cases possibly being connected. Here, we have one young woman, Jennifer Barzilowski, whose disappearance received very little media coverage at all for 2.5 years until Felicia Thomas went missing and people started noticing the links between them, particularly involving Stephen Allen Martin. I previously mentioned that the earliest reporting about Jennifer's case mentioned her having issues with heroin and possibly running off to Philadelphia to score drugs, so I'm guessing that the police pretty much wrote her off as a runaway and did not aggressively pursue an investigation. Of course, the main narrative which has been pushed forward by Felicia's mother, Pauline Bailey, is that her daughter went missing because she had taken the initiative to try and solve Jennifer's case herself, and since Felicia believed that Steve was responsible for what happened to Jennifer, he may have decided to get rid of her too. Well, if that is actually what happened, then the ironic thing is that Steve's strategy backfired in a huge way, since Felicia's disappearance brought a bunch of attention to this entire story, and even though Steve was never officially charged with either of these crimes, he still wound up experiencing a major downfall. Pauline has stated in interviews that prior to her disappearance, Felicia told her that she believed Steve had buried Jennifer in his basement, but we know that part is likely not true, since Jennifer's skull was found in a wooded area. However, this spot was in very close proximity to Steve's residence and the mobile home where Felicia was allegedly killed at a party, so there has always been speculation that Felicia's remains and the rest of Jennifer's remains are in that same general region of Hunlock Township. But before I talk any more about Felicia's case, I'm going to start off by analyzing Jennifer's death, since there obviously isn't all that much evidence to discuss. Since all that was found was Jennifer's skull, I guess it's technically never been conclusively proven that she was the victim of a homicide. I mean, theoretically, I guess you can't completely discount the possibility that Jennifer could have wandered out into the woods and died of exposure or something, but that's extremely unlikely. The only confirmed facts we have is that the last known person to see Jennifer alive was Steve Martin, who claimed he dropped her off outside the C Major Sports Bar in Edwardsville. Since Jennifer's sister Leanne was Steve's girlfriend, and she continued to remain with them for the next 2.5 years, I'm guessing she did not question Steve's story or believe he was responsible for Jennifer's disappearance. But the issue is that investigators could not find any witnesses to confirm that Jennifer was anywhere near that bar on the night she disappeared. At the time, it might not have seemed implausible that Jennifer hitched a ride there with an unknown party and traveled to Philadelphia or something, but it just seems like too much of a coincidence that her skull would turn up only about a mile away from Steve's former residence. While I have no idea what motive Steve would have had to kill Jennifer, the fact that he would eventually be charged with multiple acts of predatory behavior towards teenage girls definitely shows a pattern with Steve, So perhaps he tried the same thing with Jennifer, and things escalated into violence. Of course, that's all just speculation, as there is no real evidence that Steve did anything, and just because no witnesses recalled seeing Jennifer in the bar that night does not necessarily mean his story about dropping her off is not true. But when you consider the later issues involving Steve, the idea of him harming Jennifer is certainly not implausible. It really is crazy to see how much of a downward spiral Steve went through after he was named as a person of interest in these cases, because in the span of one calendar year, he was arrested on no less than 3 occasions for separate incidents involving different teenage girls, and then wound up being charged with vehicular homicide for taking the life of Vera Simon. Steve's defense attorney would argue that Vera's death was the result of him cracking under the extreme pressure of being falsely accused of Felicia and Jennifer's disappearances, and that he only tried to outrun the police because he had become paranoid they were attempting to railroad him. Of course, that's a pretty lame excuse for his actions, and I know that when Steve read a tearful apology to Vera Simon's family at his sentencing hearing, a lot of people thought it came across as very insincere, considering that Steve couldn't even get the family's last name right and kept referring to them as Simpson instead of Simon. And while I'm sure Steve didn't intend on killing Vera, that doesn't change the fact that many of the inappropriate incidents with the teenage girls took place before Felicia even went missing, and since he ultimately pled guilty to all these charges, he can't argue that he was falsely accused. So the motive for Steve's suicide is still up for debate, as even though I'm sure that serving 51 to 126 months in prison for Vera's death would not be a picnic, he would be released eventually and still have the opportunity to continue on with his life. But I will add the disclaimer that Steve had not yet been sentenced for the charges with the teenage girls, so it was possible that he was going to have a lot more years added on and serve a much lengthier sentence. It's been theorized that the breaking point which led to Steve's suicide was when Leanne told him she had started dating someone else, and he also found it difficult to be away from his children, but it's also been speculated that the guilt and paranoia associated with his potential involvement in what happened to Felicia and Jennifer drove him to take his own life. Of course, the families of the two victims were left disappointed by Steve's suicide because the remains had not yet been found, and they felt that Steve may have taken the secrets about what happened to them to his grave. However, in Felicia's case at least, there has been speculation that Steve was not the only person involved, and there might be others out there who know the full truth. I will say that Felicia's mother, Pauline Bailey, as well as her friend Judy Fisher, have been amazing advocates for Felicia, as they have never stopped spreading awareness about her disappearance, as well as Jennifer's death. Looking through the news archives, it seems like without fail, Pauline has made sure to hold a vigil for Felicia every year on the anniversary of her disappearance, and I have no doubt that she will do the same thing for the 20-year anniversary, which is taking place a few days after this episode's release. Pauline has not hesitated to express her belief that Felicia was murdered and that Steve Martin was involved, but over the years, it seems like a number of people have shared information with both her and Judy to make them believe there was an active conspiracy to cover up Felicia's death. For years, the narrative seemed to be that Felicia inexplicably vanished from her residence in the middle of the night, and during my research, the first source I found which started reporting on the story about Felicia being killed at a party was the Crime Watch Daily episode which aired in 2016. The show's portrayal of this story was heavily sensationalized, and also brought up an angle involving convicted serial killer Hugo Selensky, who had lived on a property in the same region of Luzerne County. So, I actually talked about Hugo Selensky back on episode number 98 of this podcast, as he was looked at as a potential suspect in the disappearance of Cindy Song, a 21-year-old Penn State student who vanished from State College, Pennsylvania, during the early morning hours of November the 1st, 2001. Selensky is currently serving a life sentence in prison for murder, but the authorities have been unable to determine how many people he actually killed, as bone fragments which may have belonged to as many as 12 different people were found in a burn pit on Selensky's property. Now, since Selensky was arrested in 2003, he would have been behind bars by the time Felicia went missing, so he obviously played no role in her disappearance. But since Jennifer went missing in 2001, the authorities did apparently make an attempt to search for her remains on Zelensky's property, but none of the bone fragments have been linked to her. The Crime Watch Daily episode alleged that prior to his arrest, Zelensky had been acquainted with Steve Martin and Felicia's boyfriend, Ed Radosky. In fact, it was even implied that Felicia herself may have met Zelensky, as Ed apparently took her to at least one party where Zelensky was in attendance. Like I just said, Zelensky was already incarcerated by the time Felicia disappeared, so I don't know why Crime Watch Daily felt the need to put so much focus on him, but it seemed to imply that being acquainted with Zelensky may have given Steve or other people from the community ideas about how to commit murder and dispose of a victim's body. After all, a heavily shared rumor is that after Felicia was murdered, her body was dismembered and her remains burned and scattered, much like what Zelensky did with his victims. Obviously, my main issue with the Crime Watch Daily episode is that it pushes forward the rumor that Felicia was killed after attending a party, but it also presents two different scenarios which seem to contradict each other. But before we talk any more about this angle, let's first discuss the known facts about Felicia's disappearance. We know that she left her job at the Pump and Pantry convenience store and arrived home sometime between 11:30 p.m. and midnight, but the man who gave Felicia a ride is not considered to be a suspect, and law enforcement seemed to believe his account that he saw her walk inside a residence after he dropped her off. All we know about what happened next is Ed Radosky's version of events, and even though he was also not considered to be a suspect, it's obvious that some people, including Pauline Bailey, do not believe his story. It's worth noting that when lead investigator Tom Kelly was interviewed on Crime Watch Daily, he put over Ed as being cooperative with the investigation, but would not say he was ruled out as a suspect because at that point, no one could be completely ruled out. As you recall, Ed claimed that he was sleeping on the couch until Felicia woke him up, and after she said she was going outside to get some beer from his ATV, Ed fell back asleep, and when he woke up about an hour later, Felicia was gone. On the surface, Steve would seem to corroborate Ed's story, since he claimed that he called the residence during this time period, but Felicia answered the phone and told him Ed was sleeping. However, since Ed and Steve were best friends, and there's been speculation that they were both complicit in Felicia's disappearance, they could have potentially been covering for each other. Until I learned about this whole party angle, I initially had a hard time figuring out how Felicia could have gone missing that night. The thing I can't wrap my head around is that even though Ed claimed that Felicia's cigarettes were missing, which gave him the impression that she went out somewhere, her purse and winter coat were left behind, even though it was a cold winter night. To be quite honest, the detail about the coat is the one thing which has always left me a bit skeptical that Felicia ever attended this party, because why would she have left without her coat? Ed told police that he didn't hear or see anything unusual, and that there were no signs of forced entry at the residence, so I considered the possibility that someone could have abducted Felicia while she was grabbing beer from the ATV, particularly since Ed claimed that the beer did not appear to have been touched. But once again, wouldn't have Felicia put on her coat if she stepped outside? So Ed claims that he did go out on his ATV to check if Felicia had gone to a nearby friend's house, and then returned home when it turned out she wasn't there, but we have this odd account from one of Ed's neighbors who claimed they saw multiple people going back and forth on ATVs throughout the course of the night, as well as a black truck which was parked in front of the residence until around 4:30 a.m. It sounds like investigators did not take this neighbor's account all that seriously because they supposedly had a personal grudge against Ed, and the police thought they were trying to get him into trouble, which is a pretty odd take to have in an unsolved missing persons case. But to be fair, if Felicia was killed at a party which was taking place at another location, then I'm not sure why there would be so much activity like this outside the Radosky residence. I do know that Steve was driving a 1997 Ford pickup truck during this time period, since this detail was reported during the news accounts about the vehicular homicide of Vera Simon, but none of the sources I could find mention if it was black. Regardless of whether or not the neighbor's account is true, it's still pretty strange to me that after taking the initiative to go out on his ATV and search for Felicia in the middle of the night, Ed never bothered to call the police to report her missing, or do much of anything at all for the next day and a half. He said that he just figured Felicia had gone to stay with her mother in Dorrance Township, but couldn't actually phone her because he had no minutes left on his long-distance calling card, which seems like a pretty lame excuse to me. I mean, how did Ed expect Felicia to have traveled to her mother's place to begin with? Felicia did not drive or own a vehicle at that time, and Ed's mother Catherine would often drive her to work. As you might recall, Catherine owned the house where Ed and Felicia were living, but I haven't heard any information about her whereabouts on the night Felicia disappeared, and whether or not she was at the residence at that time. Pauline has claimed that when she phoned there looking for Felicia, Catherine flat out lied to her by saying that Felicia had just stepped out to pick up her paycheck from a workplace, which of course turned out not to be true, and didn't make much sense either, since Catherine usually drove her there anyway. On the Crime Watch Daily episode, the crew showed up at Catherine's door and attempted to interview her, but she didn't want to talk to them, though she denied the allegations that her son was involved in Felicia's disappearance and claimed that Pauline has always spread false rumors about him. And of course, it does not sound like Ed himself has done any interviews about the case for nearly 2 decades. Now, as for Steve's whereabouts during the time period Felicia went missing, when he was first named as a person of interest, he claimed that after he spoke with Felicia on the phone, he went to bed until he was woken up when Leanne called him at 4 a.m. Since she had apparently been receiving a series of disturbing prank calls, Steve then headed over to her place to spend the rest of the night with her. I haven't read anything to indicate that Leanne disputed this story, but even if Steve did come see her, there's still a window of time between midnight and 4 a.m. in which Steve's only alibi is that he was sleeping, so if he was guilty, he still would have had ample time to do something with Felicia. It's interesting how Steve supposedly arrived at Leanne's place shortly after 4 o'clock, which is the same approximate time period when Ed's neighbor claimed that all this weird activity outside the Radaski residence came to a halt. And of course, if there were a bunch of witnesses who saw Ed at a party during this time period when he claimed he was at home sleeping, then that's a major red flag. One big clue during the early stages of the investigation were some anonymous notes which stated that Felicia's body was buried behind the Mountain Fresh supermarket, but a search of this area never went anywhere, and oddly, none of the sources I found have revealed where exactly these notes came from in the first place. For all we know, this may have been nothing more than a cruel prank, but what if it was someone attempting to throw off the investigation by directing the search effort towards the wrong place and away from the location where Felicia was actually buried? The most prevalent rumor is that Felicia's remains are somewhere in Hunlock Township near Golf Course Road and Timber Lane, the location of the mobile home where this party was supposedly held. The former owner of the mobile home, John Anthony Neary, has never gone on the record to publicly confirm or deny that the party took place, and in fact, I have not seen anyone personally state during an interview that they were in attendance that night. All we have are third-hand accounts from people like Pauline Bailey, Judy Fisher, and Tom Kelly, who claim that witnesses have told them they were there when Felicia was taken into a bedroom to be sexually assaulted and murdered by Steve Martin and about 3 other guys. The responsible individuals then disposed of Felicia's remains, but even though there were supposedly at least 17 people at this party when all this took place, their accounts were apparently not strong enough evidence to lead to anyone's arrest. I know it's been implied that all the witnesses from the party who were not directly involved in Felicia's murder have been too fearful to go on the record, but it is surprising to me that this many people could stay silent for 20 years, particularly since Steve, the alleged mastermind behind this crime, wound up going to prison and died by suicide. One of the biggest red flags to me is when rumors started circulating that someone brought a video camera into the bedroom to record a so-called snuff film of Felicia's rape and murder. As you know, urban legends about snuff films are a relic from the 1970s and 80s, and considering that Officer Kelly stated that he's found no evidence to indicate that a snuff film exists in this case, I wouldn't be surprised if certain stories about what happened to Felicia have been exaggerated. Like I've reiterated before, My biggest issue with this whole party scenario is that Kelly claims he has been told that Felicia was seen leaving the party with Steve and another unidentified male and then disappeared a short time later. But if Felicia was murdered at the party and then dismembered inside a nearby barn, how could she have left with the guy who was suspected of killing her? I can understand the police staying tight-lipped about certain aspects of the investigation, but I sure would like to know the credibility of the witnesses who claimed they saw Felicia leave versus the credibility of the witnesses who have told her mother that Felicia was raped and murdered inside the bedroom. The story that Kelly has pushed forward is that after Steve dropped off this other male, he and Felicia drove off together, and this was the last time she was confirmed to be alive. When Kelly was asked if the second male was Ed Rudosky, he replied that he could not confirm or deny it, a statement which can be interpreted in multiple ways. Does Kelly just not want to publicly reveal the identity of the second guy, or does he legitimately not know who it is? Since Ed and Felicia live together in the same residence, it technically wouldn't make much sense for Steve to drop Ed off and then go elsewhere with Felicia. But theoretically, if the second male is not Ed and police have interviewed him and deemed him to be credible, then there's no other conclusion that can be reached other than Steve being responsible for Felicia's disappearance. It would be one thing if Steve had acknowledged having seen Felicia that night, but his original story is that he was at home sleeping, and if there are credible witnesses placing him at other locations during that time period, then that looks pretty damning. Personally, Steve doing something to Felicia while they were alone together after he dropped this other guy off seems more believable to me than her being murdered at a party in the presence of several witnesses. However, even if Steve is the guilty party, the big unanswered question is how Ed figures into this whole situation, because even though police have never named him as a suspect, there are definitely some troubling things about his actions. The story which has been pushed forward is that Ed was left so intimidated by the people who assaulted and killed Felicia that he walked away from the party and left her to die. So even if he was not directly responsible for Felicia's death, Ed would still have reason to lie to law enforcement. Pauline has claimed that prior to her disappearance, Felicia told her that Steve murdered Jennifer Barzilowski and that she was going to prove it, which is what motivated Steve to kill her. Now, if Felicia was afraid of Steve, then it wouldn't make much sense for her to get into his truck and go to a party with him, which is why Pauline is certain that Ed was there too, as she may have felt that her boyfriend would be able to protect her. My biggest issue with this whole theory is that if Steve was paranoid that Felicia was going to expose him for killing Jennifer, then it seems really counterproductive to enlist multiple accomplices to help him murder Felicia and then commit the crime at a party in front of several witnesses. We also have this odd situation where Pauline has brought cadaver dogs to search the property where this murder took place, and they've supposedly hit on some spots where Felicia may have been dismembered. Yet police have claimed that when they've brought these same cadaver dogs to search the same location, they've turned up nothing. Given that Jennifer's skull was found less than a mile away from there, I certainly don't discount the possibility that one or more murders took place in that property at some point. I'm also intrigued by the idea that Felicia and Jennifer's remains may be in one of the ponds in that area, and Jennifer's skull washed up and flowed to the spot where it was found because of a heavy rainstorm or something. Remember, this spot was within a mile of Steve's own residence, so even if Felicia was not actually killed at this party, she may have been murdered in the same general area. Look, I certainly have no doubt that Steve was responsible for what happened to Jennifer and Felicia, and there may be others who were involved in Felicia's disappearance, or at least know more than they're letting on. I'm just a bit skeptical that the crime was this brazen and took place in full view of so many people. But as weird as this may sound, I do hope that Steve did not act alone, because at least that would mean the truth about what happened did not die with him, and there are others out there who know something and could help lead to the recovery of Felicia's remains. Since the 20th anniversary of Felicia's disappearance is almost upon us, I hope there will be extra publicity surrounding this case, and perhaps it will compel someone to come forward to the authorities with cold, hard facts. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Felicia Thomas or the death of Jennifer Barzilowski, please contact the Pennsylvania State Police at 570-697-2000. That's 570-697-2000. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. We also wanted to remind everyone that for the month of February, The Trail Went Cold will be teaming with a nonprofit organization called Season of Justice, which raises money for the families of cold case victims by helping spread awareness and doing what they can to fund DNA testing. If you would like to make a donation to Season of Justice, all the information about them is listed in our show notes and on our social media pages, but you can donate by visiting the link givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or texting trail24 to 53555. That's givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or you can text trail24 to 53555. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about a very memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries: the disappearance of wanted fugitive Randall Utterback, who has not been seen since he broke out of jail nearly 30 years ago. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1984 murder of Morris Davis. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Mary, Dragon Fiery, Dustin P, EVT, Kimberly S, Abigail B, Crystal, and Jordan M. Thank you all so much for your support. I also wanted to remind everyone that The Trail Went Cold has once again been booked to appear on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK this year, which is taking place at 133 Houndsditch in London on September the 21st and 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets to this event, please visit their website, crimecon.co.uk, and use our specialized promo code, COOL24, to get a 10% discount. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COOL24 for 10% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶